You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 12th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, Theresa May faces her MPs as she struggles to do the deal that will allow her to govern. But exactly who are her new best friends?
I think this is a tremendous opportunity, not just for this party, but for Northern Ireland in terms of the nation. And we're very much looking forward to playing our part in that.
Speak to a key figure in the Northern Ireland peace process about the potential implications of the tie-up between the Conservatives and the Democratic Unionists. Then a sweeping electoral landslide in France. We're in Paris to ask how Emmanuel Macron will use his huge mandate. In Russia, hundreds of arrests in anti-government demonstrations, but exactly who are the protesters lining up behind? And later, how California's countercultural history influenced design in the state.
The ideals of Silicon Valley are definitely rooted in the hippie counterculture, and that's really what we're trying to say in this show.
Plus, another newspaper could be about to downsize. We'll ask why The Guardian might go tabloid. All in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first of all, a quick look at some of the day's other top news stories. An appeals court in the United States has again upheld a decision blocking Donald Trump's revised travel ban on people from six mainly Muslim nations. It backed an injunction in a further setback for the president's attempts to impose the ban on people from Iran, Libya, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. Norway has proposed a ban on the Muslim full-face veil in schools, universities and nurseries. Officials say it's because it hinders communication between pupils and teachers. It is the first ban in Scandinavia, but headscarves, hats and caps could still be worn. A US congressman who body slammed a reporter has been fined and ordered to get anger management counseling. But Greg Gianfutti escaped jail. He admitted assaulting a journalist from The Guardian last month. He won an election the following day and will be sworn in within weeks. And a strong earthquake has struck off the Aegean coast. The epicenter of the 6.3 magnitude quake was 3 miles south of the town of Plumari on the Greek island of Lesbos. In the village of Vrisa, 10 people had to be taken to hospital. Tremors were also felt in Istanbul and Athens. Well, welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. 4 days on from the UK's general election, and Theresa May's hold on power looks as tenuous as it did when that shock exit poll was published on Thursday night. In the last few hours, the Prime Minister has met her backbench Conservative MPs for the first time since she led them to lose their governing majority, telling them, "I got us into this mess, I'll get us out of it." Meanwhile, as efforts continue to reach a deal with Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionists to prop up Mrs. May's minority government, it's not yet clear if there will be a Queen's speech needed to start the new Parliament as scheduled this time next week. Well, for more, I'm joined on the line now by Jonathan Powell, Chief of Staff to Tony Blair during his 10 years in Downing Street and one of the key figures in Northern Ireland's peace process during that time. Thank you very much for your time this evening. Theresa May's appearance in front of MPs was described by one person there as contrite and genuine, but she was not exactly on her knees, apparently saying she would remain as Tory leader for as long as they wanted her to do that. How long do you think they do want her to do that?
Until they can find another leader who can win an election, I suspect. I mean, all this stuff about contrite and on her knees is all sort of manufactured. It's all artificial, and that's the problem she ran into in the election. She was contrasted with Jeremy Corbyn, who was seen as relatively genuine, and she was seen as relatively artificial, and that was her problem, and carrying on with that won't help. They clearly want to find a new candidate to fight a new election. It's clear they won't fight an election with her, and it's clear they'll need an election fairly soon.
In the hours after the election result, Mrs. May immediately said that she would reach an agreement with the Democratic Unionists, went to Buckingham Palace to be reappointed by the Queen on that basis, use those 10 MPs to prop up the government. But then the following day, Downing Street said there was a deal. The DUP said it wasn't done yet. Now we're talking about the Queen's speech having to be delayed. Did she re-enter government on false pretenses?
Well, I spent 3 years negotiating with the DUP in Northern Ireland. I had to shuttle between them and Sinn Féin and the Nationalists in Northern Ireland. And they drive a very hard bargain, and if she's in a rush, they're going to go slow because they'll get as much as they can out of the negotiation. The longer they take, the better the chances of getting a good deal from their point of view. So I don't think it's false pretenses, but I think it was a big mistake and a mistake that will haunt her and probably haunt Britain and certainly Northern Ireland.
There is this question of what it means for the UK government's role in Northern Ireland, where it is supposed to be a neutral broker between the rival parties.
Exactly. I mean, since 1991, under a Tory government, Peter Brook, who was the Northern Ireland Secretary at the time, said Britain had no selfish strategic or economic interest in Northern Ireland. And from that moment on, we were basically neutral as the British government between the Unionists on one hand, the Protestants, and the Nationalists and Republicans, the Catholics, on the other side. And our aim was to be an honest broker between the two sides, to find the deal. Anything they could live with, we could live with. And that was the basis on which we reached the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. And perhaps even more importantly, it was the basis on which we resolved the problems with implementing the Good Friday Agreement from then on, right to the current day. And now to see the Northern Ireland Secretary going into talks in Belfast today and claiming he is an honest broker when he's kept in his job by the DUP is obviously makes him a laughingstock with the Nationalist Republican, indeed the other Unionist Party and the Cross-Sectarian Alliance Party.
And indeed, you say today was the start of the latest attempt to revive the Stormont Assembly. Do you think that ministers had necessarily worked through all the potential implications, or they just looked at the maths after election night and thought, ah, they've got 10 MPs, they'll do?
I worry that some of them didn't even know what the implications would be. I mean, I'm sure the Northern Ireland Secretary would have, but he would not have been a decision maker in terms of propping the government up. They just thought, God, where are we going to go? We can't go with Labour. The Liberals have made it clear they won't join us. We can't do the SNP. Who are we going to go to? Ah, there are 10 MPs. They're the Unionists. We used to have an alliance with Unionists in the old days. Let's do it again. Now, what they don't know is these are rather different Unionists. These are not the official Unionists of a rather tame kind. They used to have alliances with back in the 60s and 50s and 40s. This is a different sort of party altogether. This is Ian Paisley's firebrand DUP, who were in their day very radical indeed. Indeed, Ian Paisley himself played a part in starting the trouble that led to 30 years of violence by trying to storm the Sinn Féin offices in West Belfast. So this is a very different kettle of fish, and I fear that they didn't even realise what they were getting themselves into. And the really sad thing is this is something that could potentially undermine 20 years of hard work to get to peace in Northern Ireland, just to hang on to power for a few more months or perhaps another year.
And some Conservative MPs, newly elected, reporting that they were getting a lot of pressure back in their constituencies at the weekend from people who were learning for the first time where the DUP stands on some social issues, the opposition to equal rights in terms of gay marriage, anti-abortion stance, views on climate change. And one Conservative MP in a newspaper saying, I don't think the people in Downing Street realise how much attitudes have changed in the last 30 years in the sort of places where we still have MPs.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the DUP, of course, was born out of a religious party rather than the other way around. They were born out of Ian Paisley's Free Presbyterian Party, which had very, very traditional views on abortion, on LGBT issues, and all the rest of it. And they're back in the 1950s. Now, some say that Theresa May was trying to take Britain back to the 1950s, but I don't think she had quite this aspect of the 1950s in mind. So that will make a very uncomfortable marriage, particularly for the Scottish Conservative Party, that's done particularly well in the elections. And their leader has made it clear that she feels very uncomfortable of an alliance of this sort. I don't think that alliance will change anything in the Conservative Party. There's no way they're going to adopt the DUP's views on social issues. That won't happen. I think the real problem is this constitutional issue, that they are going to be popped up day to day by the DUP. At any one morning, the DUP can wake up and pull the plug on this government. And as a result, whatever they put on paper about their agreement on supporting the government, the Tory party, know that if they do what the DUP doesn't want on constitutional issues in Northern Ireland, their government is over. And that will influence what they do. And that will mean that they can't be honest brokers. And it will mean that we undermine the role that we've played for all these years.
And this isn't the same as the coalition the Conservatives agree with the Liberal Democrats, where they merge their manifestos and govern as a single party. The DUP is just going to prop them up on certain votes. And as you say, that means that at some point down the line, they can just threaten to pull the plug if they don't get something else.
Literally, on any given day, they could just change their minds and say, OK, we're not voting for you now. and the Tory party is out. So that's going to concentrate minds in Downing Street. And when it comes to negotiating on things like trying to get this executive up, because you remember that the executive has collapsed in Northern Ireland over a heating scandal presided over by Arlene Foster, the First Minister. Well, actually, she was the minister, relevant minister at the time. And that's why the government collapsed. And since then, the Irish government and the British government have been trying to put the two together again to get the executive running. Because if they don't get the executive running, there either have to be new elections, which nobody wants in Northern Ireland. They've had a whole series of elections in previous months. Or we have to have direct rule from Whitehall again. And that is certainly something that's not desirable because the Irish government and the Sinn Féin and the SDLP, the Moderate Catholic Party, none of them accept that as legitimate. They do not accept that as part of the Friday Agreement, although the unionists do. So we're forced to reimpose direct rule under DUP influence. That is going to be very, very unfortunate in terms of ever getting an executive up and running again.
So politicians on all sides saying they understand the last thing that British voters want to do is be dragged back to the polling stations again. But it does feel inevitable. How long can something like this last before we have to have another election?
Well, my predictions for the last few elections have been completely wrong. So I
As have all of our predictions.
So I don't think I'm in any position to tell people what will happen. But a government like this historically cannot last for very long. We have a very wounded Prime Minister. She's been humiliated by her own party, let alone by the opposition. We're going into these Brexit negotiations, which are really fundamental, probably the most serious challenge to the British government since the Second World War. And we're going in with a desperately weak government that can't actually sustain its position in the House of Commons. So I don't quite know how we get out of this. This is going to be a real mess. And it's quite possible that the Brexit negotiations collapse. And on the back of that, probably the government collapses and tries to go to the country on a Brexit-type issue. But this election made clear people do not vote in elections on Brexit. They're not that interested in Europe. If they're asked a question in the referendum, they'll vote on it. But their real interest is in much bigger issues like education, health, tax policy, and those sort of things, not on Brexit.
Jonathan Powell, former Chief of Staff in Downing Street, thank you very much for your time. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, while the result of Britain's election was anything but decisive, in France, the new president, Emmanuel Macron, remains very much the dominant figure in the country's politics. In the first round of voting in France's parliamentary elections, his La République En Marche party and its allies look set to win more than three quarters of the seats when the second round is held. Further dominance for a party that was, after all, only created a year ago. Well, let's speak now to the journalist and commentator Christine Ocran, who is in Paris for us now. Christine, the polls did suggest that Mr. Macron's party would do very well in these elections, but the implication of this is that he will have total dominance.
Well, I must say, in sharp contrast to the British Prime Minister, the new French president has mastered this electoral process because he understood that after the presidential election, first of all, the French want to be coherent for once, and they want to give him a chance to get the country in better shape. And the second phenomenon, in spite of a very low level of participation, is the fact that the traditional parties, which had already collapsed during the presidential election, well, they keep on sort of with a slow death, and particularly the Socialist Party, which is near extinct. And so I think that what happened yesterday, and of course there's a second round next Sunday, and the Conservatives in particular will try very hard to re-kink the energy of their own constituencies. But it is indeed, I think, a sign that the French really want to give Macron a chance, and desperate as they were with the performance of the traditional political parties.
Now, the turnout in the election was significantly lower yesterday than 5 years ago, but that is presumably just a measure of just how demoralized Mr. Macron's rivals now are.
Yes, indeed. And I think it also shows that, voters who at the presidential election voted for Marine Le Pen on the far right, or indeed Mélenchon on the far left, just feel tired, and they don't believe that these two political parties can perform any better for their own fate. And so I think the low turnout expresses a disaffection with the traditional parties, again, the socialists primarily, but also the conservatives to a certain extent, and also the extremist parties.
Now, many of those entering parliament or likely to enter parliament under Mr. Macron's banner in this election have very little, or sometimes no, political experience. So they face a very steep learning curve.
Yes, indeed. That's the paradox. Because, for years, we would lament, oh, always the same faces, always the same politicians. And now that especially we journalists will have to turn to people we've never seen, we'll have to invite on all these TV debates people who are really coming out of nowhere, even if it is fair to say that in the sociology still is more middle class than really popular candidates. But on the whole, yes, indeed, this is a very much what Emmanuel Macron promised to do, which is a fairly complete renewal of the French political class.
So at the moment, this is obviously the sort of the dictionary definition of a honeymoon period for Emmanuel Macron, but he wants to cut the number of public sector workers by more than 100,000. He wants to shave 60 billion euros off the budget. It wouldn't take much for him to start running into criticism.
Well, I mean, criticism is very necessary in any democracy. But even trade unions, which are traditionally more conservative than political parties in France, four out of five are now considering that indeed there has to be a change in our labor laws in order to get the country out of unemployment. The French have been living for almost two generations now with a 10% unemployment rate, which is really unbearable. And so I think that, of course, there will be difficulties. Of course, there will be negotiations. But so far, Macron has only been in charge for 1 month. He's fairly much accomplished what he promised to do, starting with this government, which is, half conservative and half one-third civil society, half women. I mean, all these criteria, which he promised would indeed signify a change in the style and also in the content of his policies, well, he's pretty much stuck to his word.
Christine, thank you very much. That's the journalist Christine Ocon joining us from Paris. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Who can say where the world's headed? Well, with Monocle's transport-themed June issue in tow, you'll reach your destination enlivened and entertained, and with a good read on where things are heading. We stop off in Van, a Turkish city with a Persian pull that's luring fun-loving Iranians across the border. We meet Munich's fast-moving mobility players, get in gear with the finest bike retailers, and work up a sweat at Techno Gym's Toothsome HQ in Emilia Romagna in Italy. We're also on set in New York, in Hamburg for the annual Aircraft Interiors Expo, and in Albania for the Prime Minister's fictional final feast. All that, plus Oslo's fashion startups, the small-scale supermarkets with big ideas, and a peek at London's most ambitious new hospitality venture. So strap in. Monocle's high-octane transport issue is on newsstands now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
Well, next to Russia, where hundreds of people have been arrested today at anti-corruption rallies in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But the man who set up those demonstrations, Alexei Navalny, was detained at his home before they even started. He remains one of Vladimir Putin's most high-profile critics, and his promise to run for the presidency next year clearly has many people in the Kremlin rattled. Well, joining me in the studio, the Russia analyst Stephen Diel, and also James Rogers, who's head of international journalism studies at City University in London. Thanks to both of you for coming in. As you enter the studio, we hear that Navalny has now been sentenced to 30 days in prison for staging an unsanctioned protest. I don't think, James, that's a big surprise.
No, I don't think it is. I suspect that Mr. Navalny probably put this, calculated this when he was deciding how he was going to organise his demonstration. The Russian authorities are extremely strict about people having to get the correct permission to hold demonstrations. Even sometimes when that permission is granted, miraculously, stages aren't available, public address systems aren't available, and so on. So I think given that on this occasion, Mr. Navalny and his supporters did not have permission for holding this demonstration in that particular location, he probably expected this.
Stephen, I mean, he did have permission to stage any number of demonstrations today, but then the location was switched almost as if he wanted to be arrested.
Yeah, no, I think this is guaranteed to give him more publicity, which is what he's after. He is he's running, well, if he's allowed to run, he's going to run for president next year. He really is trying to stir up society, and he's having some success. I mean, let's, you know, not just concentrate on his arrest. You know, there were in, I don't know how many, I think probably at least 100 cities and towns across Russia, there were demonstrations today. It was a public holiday, so people could take the time off. And he has set up in so many places across Russia headquarters for his movement, to really aimed at getting him elected as president next year. He's being a real thorn in the side of the authorities. And this, of course, is not the first time. There were big demonstrations in March that he called for, and he's calling for them on under a banner of anti-corruption, which is resonating with an awful lot of people.
And this dates back to him blogging sort of 10 years ago or so about corruption inside Russian corporations and then widening that into an attack on Putin's party.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the party of what was it called, swindlers and crooks. As he nicknamed it, and that caught on with a lot of people. And then, of course, what he's done very cleverly is he's produced a series of videos, and in fact, and he has his own channel on YouTube. I was watching it this afternoon as they were switching from one city to another, so you could genuinely see there were hundreds, in some cases thousands of people out on the streets of these cities. And on his video channel, he's produced some very, very professional videos. The one in particular, 45 minutes long, and very meticulous, going through the details of showing how Dmitry Medvedev, the prime minister, has suddenly become the owner of 6 palaces, the best way to describe them, and a couple of yachts. And people saying, listen, people, you know, as prime minister, he's supposed to be paid a certain salary. How on earth can he have all this? And that's what's really, people are sitting up and saying, yeah, this isn't right.
James, you've met Navalny while working in Russia. What do you make of him?
Well, I think he's a very interesting character. I mean, I think in some ways it's an example of the complexity of the Russian political system. I think he's not really fully understood here. I think a lot of people in the West look at him and see somebody who's an opponent of Mr. Putin, whereas Mr. Navalny himself thinks of himself very much as a nationalist. I think there's an assumption perhaps in the West, because of his anti-Putin stance, that he's some sort of Western-looking liberal Democrat, and that's not really the case. So he's quite an interesting character in that sense. I'd just like to pick up on something which Stephen said, which I think is very, very significant, which is Stephen you've mentioned the large number of places where this is taking place. I mean, it has, of course, Moscow and St. Petersburg are the main focus of demonstrations like this. But a lot of Russian journalists whom I follow on Twitter were making something of the fact this morning that, obviously, because of the time zones, this is where the demonstration started. There were demonstrations in places like Yakutsk in Siberia. So very much away from Western European Russia, the big cities, the focuses of major economic activity. So I think, you know, the opposition will take some encouragement from the fact that these were happening in outlying areas as well as in the major Western Russian cities.
And is that indicative of a level of displeasure that will alarm the Kremlin further, or will they think that they can ride this out the way they always have?
It frankly doesn't take very much to alarm the Kremlin. I mean, I remember when I was living in Russia in the middle of the last decade, and reporting on, you know, this was a time when the economy was booming. Mr. Putin's popularity ratings were somewhere north of 90%, and they may have been slightly fixed, but not much. You know, you could take those pretty much at face value. Everybody was enjoying disposable income, the like of which they'd pretty much never seen before, certainly in the big cities. And occasionally there were demonstrations of people who were fed up with the, you know, what they saw as a curtailing of political freedoms. I remember having a discussion with a member of Mr. Putin's press team once, and he said, you know, why do you cover these demonstrations? And I said to him, look, for me as a Western correspondent, it's not a story if 1,000 people turn up in the middle of a city of 10 million and say, you know, Mr. Putin must go. What is a story is when you send 10,000 riot police to surround them. And they've always, even in the good times, been very nervous about this. They like to have absolutely everything under control because, you know, I think they look around. I think the Russian administration looks on very, very nervously at any country where there's a revolution or a sudden change, and they're aware that it can happen quickly here. Personally, I mean, I think that this kind of crackdown is probably counterproductive because, you know, Mr. Navalny wanted to get arrested. He's going to get more coverage, draw more attention. And we've seen all over the media today the picture of, you know, riot police in sort of Darth Vader gear dragging teenage girls away to jail.
Now, Stephen, just to pick up something James said, that there's an assumption, isn't there, in many Western countries that anybody who opposes Vladimir Putin must, by definition, be better than Vladimir Putin. And so we may just enthusiastically support him as not Putin without necessarily knowing who he is.
That's true. No, and James makes a very good point that Navalny is a patriotic Russian. What we have to hope is, if were he ever to come to power, is that he would be patriotic in the sense of one of his great countrymen said some years ago that a patriot is someone who loves his own country and loves other countries. A nationalist is someone who loves their own country and hates other countries. So if he is a true patriot and if he respects other countries, then we're making progress. But no, he is not some sort of Western liberal. And he stresses this point, you know, I am a patriot, we are patriots. It's just his use of the word patriot is rather different from Putin's use. So yes, we must be careful. James makes a very good point there. But the problem is really that Putin and the clique around him, I mean, they, you know, they've been robbing the country blind. They are corrupt. We all know that. Or every Russian knows that. This is actually people standing up to them. And that's why they get so worried, because actually what really frightens them is a mass movement that they can't control. At the moment, they try to control everything. One of the first things Putin did when he came to power in 2000 was control the media, because he thought, right, people watch television, if I can get them by television. Suddenly, he's finding a younger generation, we saw this in the March demonstrations, a younger generation who don't watch television the way their parents did, who are getting their news and information on social media, and they don't know how to control that. So that worries them. And there's a word in Russian, bunt. And bunt means a kind of spontaneous uprising. And that is something that really, really frightens the people in power in Russia. If you get some sort of spontaneous uprising, for whatever reason, there was a case a few years ago in a suburb in the south of Moscow where an Azeri trader had murdered a Russian over a row over a girl. And there was almost a pogrom. In the next couple of days, it really turned into almost a riot, attacking the Azeris. Now, as James said, they sent in thousands of police, riot police, and interior ministry troops, not because they wanted to protect the Azeris, but because they were absolutely terrified that if something got out of hand, it's a spark that could cause a huge flame, and that really does worry them.
Yeah. So if they're that nervous, James, how how do we rate Navalny's chances of actually getting on the ballot for the presidential election?
Good question, actually. I mean, he may succeed in doing that if the authorities think that they can sort of manage the effect of it. I mean, I think one thing which will concern them, and one thing that's very important, I think, to bring into the discussion we're having this evening is the generation thing. You know, Stephen mentioned that when Mr. Putin came to power, he started by controlling the media. But I think there was also a generation of Russians who remembered the decade of, frankly, of chaos which followed the end of communism. And I remember talking to liberal, you know, young Russians about, you know, 10, 15 years ago and saying, well, look, it's all very well, but, you know, I remember the 1990s, it was complete chaos. And yes, we would like more democracy, but we really don't want to go back to that. With this new generation who we see on the streets now, they don't remember that. They don't have that folk memory. And as Stephen says, you know, they're not as impressed by state media as they might otherwise be. So I think, you know, that I think that is probably what the most significant thing is, the age of these demonstrators and the fact that they don't have any of that baggage because they weren't even born in that decade, you know, which Mr. Putin really made his political reputation saying, this is over now. We're not having this chaos anymore. We're going to build a strong Russia again.
It's a fascinating conversation. Thanks, both of you, very much for coming in this evening. James Rogers and Stephen Diel. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, the fashion world has been based in London for the last few days because it's London Fashion Week Men's, which is the first stop on the menswear calendar. One of the standout collections came from up-and-coming designer Nicholas Daly, and Monocle's Jamie Waters caught up with him backstage.
So I studied BA Fashion Honours at Central St Martins. I graduated in 2013. And then my graduate collection was bought by International Gallery Beams in Japan, who are based in Shibuya. And basically they bought my graduate collection and basically started the catalyst for my brand. I wasn't quite sure whether immediately after St. Martin's that I'd start my own brand, but I felt this was a great opportunity. And since then, the Japanese market has been really receptive and understanding of my concept and the clothing. So Japan's been going really great. So what I wanted to do this season with BFC was apply for the new gen and try to engage with a new audience, like a homegrown audience as well. It's one thing doing it in Japan, but obviously doing it here on home soil with friends and family and be able to present my ideas, not just through clothing and a lookbook, but also to be able to do it with sound and smell, with the incense and the sitar. You know, it's all these elements which now I can play with and be able to convey, you know, my story and like what I want to present to the audience.
You've mentioned that obviously your concept's been really popular in Japan and they've really got it. What exactly is that concept and what is the, you know, you've mentioned there was sitar playing in the background in your presentation. What is this background or concept that you're sort of creating?
I think it's probably, you know, showing that sort of cross-cultural exchange and things which might not be able to get so much limelight on in terms of, you know, certain communities or textiles which haven't really been pushed forward. Even with like Madras Check at the V&A, the creators there say they don't have a lot of people who are looking to see those particular artifacts. And obviously, you know, for me being a mixed heritage with Scottish and Jamaican, like I always feel it's important to kind of show that cross-cultural exchange and also bring forward these great stories which might not necessarily be kind of brought forward. Like for example, you know, outside of Scotland, the next best place that makes bagpipes is in Pakistan. There's all these amazing things, or like Madras Check was actually used during the slave trade. Slave owners would use Madras Check or tartan or checked fabrics as a way of identifying their slaves. So there's all these very both positive, negative and quite funny aspects to cloth and textiles. And I think that's the reason why I chose Madras Check, because with my previous work, like looking at tartan and looking at jute, when you look at certain textiles, you can really like go and dig and really peel all the interesting things about it, which a lot of people might not necessarily know. And that's what I think special about what I'm trying to do is like informing people, not just, you know, obviously the clothes got to look good and the silhouette and all the models and the casting, but, you know, ultimately it's like trying to inform the market and consumers and people. You know, there's people, especially now in the political context, a lot of people are looking at contrasts rather than comparisons. And I think there's a lot of history, and looking at cloth and textiles is quite a nice way of seeing that kind of story between different cultures, whether it's India and Scotland or whether it's Jamaica and, you know, or just looking at all different places. And I think looking at textiles and cloth is a great way of showing that diversity and history.
How important do you think it is to, sort of as a political comment, or just how important generally to show a different culture in, you know, London Fashion Week or even a European context? Yeah. I mean, I know like there's other young designers like Grace Wells Bonner also is showing, you know, African cultures. Yeah. But how important is it to do something different, you know, seeing a different culture represented?
Well, I just think, you know, it's just good to have diversity and to coming from a mixed background, you know, it's part of my DNA, you know, my sort of, you know, in terms of what I represent and what I want to try and say, and just celebrating the diversity, like even through the casting, you know, like using lots of different guys from, you know, we had one guy who's from Nepal, and then we had Edwin, and then we had Abdo. So it's like, you know, all amazing characters. And I think for me, you know, it's just like trying to show more diversity and like another story to maybe not always the lens which normally is always focused on during Fashion Week. And it's quite nice, you know, to just be able to express how I feel and how I see the world and what I think is important to get out, you know, to the fashion market and also beyond, you know, in terms of the textiles, the casting, the whole thing as a package. So
I wanted to quickly dive into some of the specific pieces in the presentation. Can you talk us through a couple of your favourite designs?
I'd say the kilt was a great thing. So that's made in Scotland, just outside of Motherwell. And we then designed a bespoke Czech fabric with a factory in Yorkshire. And the actual textiles Czech was based on one of the Madras archive Czechs, which I saw in the research. So
at the V&A.
Yeah, at the V&A, sorry. So it was a nice way of intertwining, you know, British craftsmanship with, you know, looking at, you know, traditional South Asian Madras textiles. So it was a really nice mixture of both like the history as well as like the modern production of what mills can do, and also making a product like the kilt, which is such a prominent garment in the library of like British kind of clothing, so strong. So yeah, it's like that for me is like a really nice garment which kind of has all the elements mixed into it.
There was also this great sort of oversized patchwork coat which I loved.
So we rebuild from the lungis. So lungis are normally worn for like just wrapping around your trousers or over your shoulder. It's like across like South Asia, it's like very common. So basically we just wanted to use that and rebuild it and just kind of give it like a slightly new, like fresh kind of angle on it, rather than just always seeing it in its normal context. So it's kind of like rebuilding and reusing and appropriating that and giving it like a new form. So like this big shirt which I'm wearing is like a patchwork of different textiles, and the jacket which you mentioned, again, that's like a patchwork of all different Madras lungi textiles. So again, it's like all these different Czech stories. So we've got like the bespoke woven Yorkshire kilt, and then we've got the rebuild lungis as well. So you've got these two different Czech stories which still kind of all work together and kind of just like sort of express my kind of research and thoughts on that sort of textile. Yeah.
And that's the designer Nicholas Daly speaking there to Monocle's Jamie Waters. Well, next to California, not perhaps the first place you might imagine is always on the cutting edge of design, but a new exhibition at London's Design Museum celebrates California as one of the world's most progressive design hubs, whether that's a low-slung motorbike or 30 years worth of Apple computers. The exhibition shows just what the state has offered to the rest of the world. To find out more, Monocle's Josh Fennett paid a visit to the museum.
My name is Kyle Osbrink. I'm a curatorial assistant at the Design Museum for the California Designing Freedom Exhibition. And right now we are standing in front of the Waymo autonomous self-driving car and a replica of the Captain America motorcycle from the film Easy Rider.
So already we have a sense of the dramatic exhibition that you've pulled together. You yourself are a native Californian, and in taking up this theme, what do you think these two items start by saying as people first walk into this exhibition? What does a self-driving car say about California?
Well, basically, our guiding principle for putting the show together was about tools of personal liberation. And we wanted to make a big statement as soon as people walked into the show about what that really means. And putting these two vehicles side by side speak to the two different forms of
personal liberation from the 1960s to present day. So starting in the 1960s, you know, the idea of personal liberation and personal freedom was two wheels and the open highway. Contrasting that to today's idea is more about the freedom from having to drive to work or drive really anywhere, where you can get in a car that comes to your location that does not have a steering wheel, and giving over your control of the vehicle to artificial intelligence to have it take you where you need to go.
And as we look at these as just even visual clues about the time from which they come, we've got a kind of low-slung, old glory-clad chopper and a kind of little car that looks a little bit like a British policeman's helmet. I mean, what does that tell you about the priorities and how they've changed? You've got this sense of rebellion at the start and then almost this sense of consensus at the end that we can all work together.
I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, the ideals of the Silicon Valley are definitely rooted in the hippie counterculture, and that's really what we're trying to say in this show, that the ideas of that were established back in the 1960s of dropping out, of rebellion, of self-sufficiency, of living off the grid, these are all the sort of founding principles that guided a lot of the tech industry that produced all the products that we use today all the time. And that's really the thrust of the show.
So we've walked a few paces across the room and we're confronted by some extremely bright printed images. Maybe you could tell us what we can see here.
Well, again, starting in the 1960s, we have a work by Corita Kent, who was a practicing nun in Los Angeles. She taught the Immaculate Heart College art department, and she created a lot of pop art-influenced posters and prints that were very much about political activism and spirituality. And they were contemporary of, you know, the pop artists of the day, like Andy Warhol, Lichtenstein, those kinds of people. And they used a lot of, you know, contemporary and everyday kind of imagery and mixed it with poetry, with scripture, and with empowering messages that were very emblematic of the time period that they came from.
When the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part.
So what we see in front of us is a series of kind of four pictures. It looks like are they hand-painted with kind of little poetry screeds beneath them, is that right?
They're serigraphs, so they're silkscreen prints. Basically, you can see a context photo over here showing the classroom that Corita worked in, so you can see a bunch of 60s looking art students being taught under the tutelage of a bunch of nuns at this college in Los Angeles. So it's sort of an interesting mix of faith-based education and the counterculture sort of fusing together.
And if we fast forward, where do you pick up this thread in modern day California?
We're now standing in front of a poster by Shepherd Fairey, which he produced after the election, the 2016 election. And this was very much a response to a lot of the sort of negative aspects that came out of the election, a lot of feelings of division and feelings of resistance and protest that arose out of the results of the election.
Oddly, that religious theme pops up again. I mean, here Yes. We see a woman with her head covered in a headscarf, which is the American flag. And, you know, before the thread I suppose you're picking up on is that thread of religion, that it's never too far from debates in American society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the statement that he's making here, it's a whole series called We the People. This is the woman in the star-spangled hijab is one. Basically, it depicts a series of women of various ethnicities, various backgrounds, and various faiths who are all depicted in a very empowering way. This one in particular says, we are greater than fear. And one of the things that Shepherd Fairey did with these posters that was very unique was that he made all these posters available for download for free so that anyone could download them, print them, take them to protests, take them to rallies. It's a democratization of his work, which is sort of the antithesis to a lot of artists who want to view their works as very precious and very unique. He wanted to make this available for the people for whatever ends that they wanted to use it for. And it ended up being a very successful campaign that was used a lot. You saw it a lot in the women's marches. Again, it's connecting back to the counterculture movement of resistance, of empowerment, of speaking your voice, and but using a very, you know, modern 2017 interpretation of that using technology.
And that's Kyle Osbrink speaking to Monocle's Josh Fennett about that exhibition, California Designing Freedom, which is on at London's Design Museum through until the 15th of October. Up next on the Monocle Daily, we'll take a look at some of the big stories from India. Do stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Well, time now for a look through some of the big stories from across Asia. Our focus tonight to be India. My guest in the studio is Sumnath Bettabayal from SUS, University of London. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. Now, we were hearing last night and this morning that Donald Trump doesn't want to come to Britain because he's worried that some people might be rude to him.
Some.
possibly more than some. But we now know that when Narendra Modi goes to the US, he will definitely be popping in to the White House.
Yes. This is an interesting story. Most such visits of head of state and meetings are announced months in advance. This is not even 2 weeks left. There has been a lot of friction about this meeting and whether Donald Trump will meet Narendra Modi. This question has been going on for a bit. Finally, they have agreed. And the scenario is very interesting. Trump, a couple of weeks ago, has walked out of the Paris climate deal and has rubbished India and China's position on climate change and how they're tackling it, both countries. And there has been a huge conversation around H-1B visas, which affect Indian computer engineers and professionals quite hugely. So it'll be an interesting meet. A lot of stuff in the background going on. At the same time, Trump would be interested in meeting the Indian head of state simply because America is, at the moment, India's highest arms seller. So there's a lot of Trump likes trade. You know, the Middle East conversation has only been about how many billions he's got. So that conversation will also carry on. But India will focus very closely on the visa issue because it affects India hugely.
Now, a lot, I don't mean to be rude about Donald Trump, obviously, you know, heaven forfend. But quite often he meets foreign leaders. He doesn't seem to necessarily know a lot about their countries or about the issues or about why he should necessarily be interested. So while you're saying, you know, there are a lot of good reasons for this meeting to go ahead, does he necessarily know them?
Well, I wouldn't exactly know what Donald Trump knows and what he doesn't. But the fact that he did not know anything about climate change politics was very evident the moment he started saying India and China are allowed to do anything they want, emit as much carbon. Now, this is in a historical context of the last 200 years of capitalism. Trump wouldn't be expected to know that. So you see that a president who is not necessarily rigorous in his briefings, in his readings. So I guess the Indian External Affairs Ministry and their officials would prepare accordingly, having seen what has gone before with the foreign dignitaries and Trump, that they would prepare the Prime Minister, Modi, quite appropriately to expect anything.
Is there a risk that this could backfire on Mr. Modi? Because, for example, Theresa May got a lot of criticism for racing over to Washington to meet Donald Trump, for not seeming to challenge him, for seeming to sort of crawl a little bit to him. He has to be quite careful how he handles it.
Unfortunately, I wish India at this moment was as critical as the British population can be. India is a new growing economy where the differentiation about how people make money is not necessarily made. It's a new neoliberal economy rushing to for its GDP growth of double digits. So no, I don't expect that if Narendra Modi comes back with enough trade deals, I think he'll be welcomed back. If he gets a higher quota on H-1B visas, he'll be welcomed back. The critical gaze necessary. Both are very right-wing presidents and prime ministers. They might get along very well.
Now, let's move on to some other stories. Farm loan waivers. This is something that's been going on for a while, isn't it?
It's a huge story. You know, it's a huge story because the centre basically has said that, you know, the Indian government has basically said, if you need to give loan waivers to farmers, the states, the individual states should take care of it. Now, this is huge in the context of by 2030, India has to feed about nearly 130 billion people, right? The food production has to go up by about 40%, which is immense, right? 58% of India's population is engaged in agriculture. The returns are very low. Given the number of people, 58% of more than a billion people is a huge number of people. Very recently, the opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, was arrested when he went to a particular farmer protest in Maharashtra that made huge headlines. For the last 15 to 20 years, regularly, every day, somewhere in India, farmers commit suicide. This has been a story which we have ignored, right? So in this context, the center clearly coming out and saying that, look, we can't deal with this. Individual states should, is a huge statement to say that, you know, we're not really bothered about how you guys deal with it. This is not a state-wise problem. It's a central...
But doesn't that have electoral implications?
Absolutely.
If say there are nearly 600 million people in India who are actively engaged in agriculture and the government says they're really not that bothered about them.
Well, I don't think... we can construe it as not bothered. What the centre is saying, we have certain regulations, rules, promotions, waivers put in place. Beyond this, we won't go. They're trying to make a statement that subsidies beyond a point will not work. It harms the economy. And I get that argument. But without active participation, cooperation and policy, we are looking at not only a food crisis in the next 10, 15 years, we're looking at the largest employer of the Indian population, which is agriculture, facing very dire straits. This has been a disaster in the making for the last 20, 30. The post IMF structural adjustments in 1993, when the WTO came in very strongly with their, you know, no subsidy story, Indian farmers have been suffering. Indian farmer's family, a normal regular Indian farmer's family today consumes less food grain than the 1943 Bengal famine. That's the kind of disaster you're talking about. Mm. You know, it's a story which is not told. On one side, you have the European cow, the most subsidized animal in the world. And on the other side, you have an Indian farmer family who does not have food grains for his children.
It's not a cheerful way to end, but I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to leave it for this evening. But thank you very much for bringing us those stories. Sonath Batavile from SOAS here at University of London. This is Monocle 24. Now, it is 12 years since The Guardian brought Europe's Berliner newspaper format to the UK, but now it is reportedly set to ditch it and go tabloid. Now, the Berliner is taller than a tabloid, for those who haven't seen it, but narrower than a broadsheet, a kind of a shrunk-down version of a broadsheet. Very popular on the European mainland, but new to Britain when it was introduced in 2005. So, is this further evidence of the decline of printed newspapers? On the line now is George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University here in London, author of the book Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. George, thank you for joining us. These Berliner presses cost The Guardian £50 million when they put them in 12 years ago, but are sitting idle most of the time. We know The Guardian's losing money hand over fist. So from that perspective, just contracting out the printing does make some sense.
Oh, I think it's entirely about money. Actually, I think the total cost of that operation, that shift to the different format, the Berliner format, was probably about £80 million. and they'll only get a certain amount of that back if they cancel, you know, they try and sell the presses and so on. They haven't been very efficient. They're not used enough of the time. It's much cheaper for them to contract out with somebody who's printing in tabloid format, which is much commoner. There's much more machinery and so on and so on. It's all much easier for them to do, and we'll stem their losses, which have in recent years been heavy.
When The Guardian made this change in format in 2005, they said that they specifically rejected the tabloid format because it didn't suit The Guardian, because it didn't suit the way their journalism was presented. It didn't suit their reliance on publishing's arresting photography. They are going to have to completely reformat the newspaper.
Yes, I've had the experience of reformatting the newspaper. I was in charge of The Times when it moved, when in fact it printed in both sizes for a bit, from broadsheet to a tabloid or compact edition, as we liked to call it at the time. And it is a very big change. It sounds as if it's something you could do relatively frictionlessly, very, very easily. After all, the content is all the same. You're just pouring it into a different size page. Actually, the changes, the editorial changes, are quite considerable. And I can understand what The Guardian was thinking at the time. It thought, well, we don't want to do what everybody else is doing. We ought to do something different. But it's taking that particular route was very expensive. And to some extent, I think the shift away from Berliner to tabloid is probably a victory. There's been a bit of a civil war in The Guardian going on since its long-serving editor, Alan Rusbridger, stopped recently. And, some people regard him, I think with a lot of justice, as an excellent editor, but not necessarily a great business leader. And they have been dismantling quite a lot of his commercial legacy. And I think the people who wanted to dismantle his commercial legacy are probably the people who wanted to move away from the Berliner, which they regarded as an expensive mistake.
Now, you mentioned The Times as one of the newspapers that switched to a tabloid format after The Independent did the same thing. I can remember a lot of Times readers at the time complaining a lot about the loss of the broadsheet, but then getting used to it. But equally, the Saturday edition of The Times now in that tabloid format is a pretty unwieldy thing. It's hundreds and hundreds of pages. It's pretty hard to manage on a sofa.
You can't have a format which is perfect for everyone, if you see what I mean. Broadsheet, in a way, if you are assuming that large numbers of your readers are reading it in club armchairs or at the kitchen table, is not too bad. You can get a lot of information on a page. You don't have to have too many pages. The newspaper, like you say, does not have to be too thick or steady. On the other hand, if a large number of your readers are strap hanging on the tube or on trains, then a smaller format is an awful lot easier. It has great advantages. It's much easier to carry around. I agree with you that it's harder on a Saturday. If it were possible for a very rich newspaper to have a small format on weekdays and a large format on Saturdays when they want bigger pictures and more pages, then that would be perfect. But that, needless to say, is the most expensive operation you could possibly try and have.
Might that be a way for the Guardian group, as it were, to retain a sense of difference, to take the Guardian tabloid during the week, but maybe go the other way and take the Observer back to being a broadsheet? After all, the Sunday Times is still a broadsheet.
Well, they could try to do that, but I fear that it probably involves heavier costs. I mean, in design and consumer and marketing terms, that might be an attractive solution, but I suspect it would be much more expensive. And if you have been losing as much money as The Guardian has, and The Observer have been losing in recent years, cutting your costs is really the absolutely critical thing. One other thing I'd add would be that although The Guardian still makes, we don't know precisely, but probably something like 60% of its income from print, still even now, as there is a shift away from print towards online publication, if you think the shift to online is going to continue, and print won't disappear, but it'll be a smaller part of what you're going to do, if you move to a smaller format and you don't necessarily forever expect to print every day, and maybe we could assume that some of today's
switch to a weekend-only edition or something.
Will become a weekend-only edition.
Well, that'll be an interesting thing to see if that does happen. We'll have to leave it there for now, I'm afraid. George Brock, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for this Monocle Daily, produced by Daniel Giacopelli. Our researchers, Jolene Goffin, Hunter Charlton, and Antonio Fernandez, our studio manager. From me, Paul Osborne, thanks very much for listening. and goodbye.